Imagine a job site for a second. Like, really picture it. When you think of the absolute most dangerous place to be on that site, your mind probably goes straight to the darkest, most claustrophobic corners you can think of.
Right, like a dark subterranean cave-in or, a sudden methane explosion a mile underground.
Exactly. You don't usually picture a beautiful sunny day, a wide-open gravel road, and, well, the exact same truck you drive every single morning.
No, you really don't.
But that disconnect between what feels dangerous and what actually kills people is exactly what we are tearing into today.
Welcome to today's deep dive. We are unpacking a pretty sobering, but honestly incredibly insightful article by Brian Barker of True North EHS.
Yeah, he takes a really hard look at the Mine Safety and Health Administration, or MSHA, and their fatality trends for 2025.
Right. And our mission today isn't just to, throw a bunch of grim statistics at you. We want to uncover the preventable systemic failures that are hiding behind those numbers. Because understanding how safety nets unravel in mining actually teaches us how they unravel everywhere. Absolutely. And to really grasp the impact of the 2025 data, we kind of have to look at the immediate contrast with the year before. I mean, the mining industry in 2024 looked like the ultimate poster child for industrial
They
progress.
had a fantastic year, right?
Yeah, it was a near record year for safety. They finished with only 28 fatalities for the entire year, which was the second lowest in their recorded history.
Oh.
They even finished out the month of December with zero deaths. So there was this genuine, really palpable optimism across the whole industry.
Which makes sense. I mean, the expectation was probably that the trend line would just keep pointing down as technology improved and rules got tighter.
Exactly. But then 2025 hit, and that beautiful downward trend line just violently snapped.
Right.
By the end of 2025, 33 miners had died. That is an 18% increase from the previous year.
That is just brutal.
It really is. And the start of the year was especially bad. 10 miners were killed between January 3rd and March 5th alone.
Wait, just in those 2 months?
Yeah, which is more than triple the number from that exact same period in 2024. MSHA actually issued a major safety alert because of it.
So the industry took notice, the memos went out, and what, the deaths just kept coming anyway.
Unfortunately, yeah. Which brings us to why this actually matters to you listening right now. Whether you manage a heavy industrial site, oversee contractors, or honestly work in a totally different corporate environment entirely.
Because at the end of the day, 33 people drank their morning coffee, went to work, and didn't come home.
Right. Barker's analysis forces us to confront the fact that these lives were lost to incredibly ordinary, predictable, and frankly, preventable reasons. We aren't studying mysterious, unavoidable acts of nature here.
We're studying organizational behavior.
Exactly.
You know, it's one thing to see the numbers on a spreadsheet, but when you actually look at the incident reports, the real tragedy is just how mundane the hazards were.
Mundane is the perfect word for it.
Yeah, reading through Barker's breakdown, the analogy that kept popping into my head was it's like ignoring a leaky roof in your house.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
Right, like you see the water spot, you put a bucket under it, and then you just walk past it for months. You get so used to it that you actually stop seeing it as a threat. Right up until the day the ceiling completely caves in and crushes your living room.
Yeah, these are known hazards that just existed shift after shift until someone died.
Exactly. So let's talk about the primary culprit in the data because it perfectly illustrates that leaky roof concept.
Yeah, so powered haulage was the number one killer in 2025, and by a really massive margin, it accounted for 11 of the 33 fatalities.
And when we say powered haulage, we're talking about what? Haul trucks, tractors, things like that.
Right. Haul trucks, tractors, front-end loaders, just general heavy mobile equipment. But the harrowing part of Barker's specific examples is that we are not talking about unpredictable, catastrophic mechanical failures.
Like a steering column snapping out of nowhere or something.
Exactly. We aren't looking at freak accidents. We are looking at environmental conditions that were allowed to deteriorate over time.
Right, like that section on the haul truck driver who went over a berm. I was reading that and just shaking my head.
Yeah, that one is particularly tough to read about.
Because for anyone unfamiliar, a berm is supposed to be that protective mound of earth along the edge of a road or a pit, right? It's built specifically to keep a vehicle from going over the edge.
That's the exact purpose of it, yeah.
But when we talk about a haul truck going over it, we really need to understand the scale here. I mean, a mining haul truck isn't a Ford F-150.
Not even close.
These are machines the size of a two-story house. They can weigh up to 400 tons fully loaded. So how does a berm actually fail against something that massive?
Well, a berm fails because it essentially ceases to be an engineered safety structure and just becomes a pile of dirt.
Just a pile of dirt.
Right. MSHA regulations typically require a berm to be at least mid-axle height of the largest equipment using that road.
Okay, so it has to be pretty substantial.
Very substantial. But if a site manager allows that berm to erode, or, you know, if it's built with loose, uncompacted soil instead of solid material, it physically cannot stop the kinetic energy of a 400-ton machine.
I mean, physics is physics.
Exactly. So instead of acting as a retaining wall, a degraded berm just acts as a ramp.
Oh, wow. A ramp.
Yeah. And in this specific 2025 fatality, the truck went over that inadequate berm and actually fell into a water-filled pit.
Which is just a horrific thought. And the article mentions another powered haulage death involving ground failure too, right?
Yes. A contract driver was dumping material at a stockpile, and the ground beneath his truck simply gave way.
And it caused the whole thing to overturn. Again, The mechanics of that failure are just fascinating and terrifying at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
The ground didn't spontaneously turn to quicksand.
No, it didn't.
Someone just failed to verify if that specific patch of earth could actually support a multi-ton payload shifting its center of gravity as the truck bed raised up.
Right, or consider the miner who was pinned against a coal rib by a tractor.
And a coal rib, that's the solid wall of a coal pillar that is left intact to support the roof of the mine, correct?
Exactly. So operating heavy machinery in tight proximity to those totally unyielding walls requires strict spatial awareness and clearance protocols.
It leaves absolutely no room for error.
None. But the common denominator across all these haulage fatalities is what we call the normalization of deviance.
The normalization of deviance.
Yeah. The insufficient berm was there yesterday. The unstable stockpile ground was there last week. The tractor was driven too close to the rib on the previous shift.
Right. It's that psychological trap of thinking, well, I drove 10 miles an hour over the speed limit every day this week and didn't crash. So 10 miles an hour over the speed limit is the new safe baseline.
That is exactly it. You get away with it until the physics finally catch up with you.
And that normalization of deviance seems to be exactly what drives the second leading cause of death in the 2025 data, which is machinery.
Yeah, Barker identifies two main threads here with machinery, improper maintenance, and unsafe equipment operation.
Okay, so the machinery example Barker highlights actually made me stop reading and reread the entire paragraph because the sequence of events was just so baffling to me.
The one with the cutting torch?
Yes. A contractor died from severe burns because he was using a cutting torch to remove shims from a cone crusher right next to a highly pressurized hydraulic line.
Yeah, it's a very intense case study.
So the line ruptured, the fluid hit the open flame, and the whole thing caught fire.
Yeah.
Now, first off, a cone crusher is a massive piece of equipment designed to violently grind boulders into gravel. And shims are these metal wedges used to adjust the crushing gap. I get that.
Right.
But what I don't get is, why would a trained worker bring an open flame anywhere near a highly pressurized hydraulic line?
Well, to understand the why, we really have to look at how pressurized fluids behave, and maybe more importantly, the pressures of the job itself.
Okay, break that down for me.
So hydraulic systems in these machines operate at thousands of pounds per square inch. If a torch weakens the rubber or metal casing of that line, the fluid doesn't just, you know, leak out like a dripping faucet.
Right, it's under massive pressure.
Exactly. It aerosolizes. It becomes a highly flammable mist that just instantly ignites.
That is terrifying.
It is. As for why a worker would do this, honestly, it almost always comes down to time pressure.
Time pressure. So they're rushing.
Yeah. Removing those shims manually might take hours of hard labor. Burning them out with a torch takes minutes.
So a supervisor or safety manager might look at that incident and say, well, we just need to put our team through torch safety retraining.
Which is the standard response, yeah.
But Barker frames this as a hazard recognition failure at multiple levels, not just a single worker's mistake. Like, where was the job safety analysis for that specific maintenance task?
Exactly. How did the organizational culture allow time-saving shortcuts to override basic fluid dynamics?
Right. And this failure to respect stored energy isn't just limited to hydraulic lines, is it?
No, not at all. The data shows at least one death involving a failure to lock out, tag out equipment before working on it.
Lock out, tag out, or LLO, which is the process of physically placing padlocks on the energy sources of a machine, whether electrical or mechanical.
Yeah, so it literally cannot be turned on while someone is inside it fixing it.
Which is just mind-blowing to me, because MSHA has been citing LO violations for decades, I mean, it is day one safety training in literally any industrial job.
Oh, absolutely. It's as basic as it gets.
So the only reason a worker skips placing a padlock on a breaker is if they feel an intense pressure to keep the production line moving.
Right.
They trade a few minutes of saved time for a human life, assuming they'll be quick enough to get away with it.
And sadly, that assumption is deadly. Along with those equipment hazards, ground and high wall failures accounted for 4 deaths in 2025.
Remind me, a high wall is the steep, unexcavated face of a surface mine, right?
Yes. And like Elodo, the danger of falling rock from a high wall is a hazard older than the mining industry itself.
So people are being killed by the most thoroughly documented dangers in the book.
They really are. And this brings us to a massive pivot in the data. And honestly, this part completely shattered my own assumptions.
Okay, lay it on me.
We've established the mechanisms of these fatalities, right? The trucks, the pressurized lines, the falling rock.
Right, the what and the how.
But the location of these deaths completely upends our conventional expectations. This is the critical mental model shift that Barker urges the industry to make.
Because if you ask someone on the street where a miner is most likely to die, they definitely picture being trapped a mile beneath the surface in the dark.
Exactly. But Barker reveals that 78% of the 2025 mining fatalities occurred above ground.
Wait, 78%? Almost 8 out of 10 deaths.
Yes. Almost 8 out of 10 deaths happened at surface mines and surface facilities, not deep in a subterranean shaft out in the open.
I have to push back on the psychology of this, though.
Okay, go for it.
Because you mentioned earlier that surface mining involves 400-ton haul trucks and massive cone crushers tearing boulders apart, right? How can anyone stand next to machinery the size of an apartment building and somehow feel safe just because the sun is shining?
It's totally counterintuitive, I know. But it comes down to how human biology perceives threat.
Okay, how so?
When you are underground, the environment itself is actively, visibly hostile. The darkness, the confined space, the reliance on artificial ventilation, it all creates a sort of low-level claustrophobia.
Like your body knows it's not supposed to be there.
Exactly. Your brain is constantly receiving signals that you are in a dangerous place, which keeps your guard up.
That makes a lot of sense.
But on the surface, you have sunlight, fresh air, an open sky. You can see for miles. That lack of claustrophobia naturally suppresses your fight or flight response.
Wow.
Yeah, the human brain equates open space with safety, even if that open space contains a 400-ton truck driving straight toward you.
So the worker in the sunny gravel pit actually feels less immediate peril than the worker in the coal shaft, even if the gravel pit worker is statistically in far more danger.
Precisely. And that psychological blind spot infects the entire industry, from the operators all the way up to the regulators.
How does it affect the regulators?
Well, Barker points out that because of this ingrained cultural assumption, surface operations often receive far less rigorous safety oversight.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They generally face fewer formal inspections compared to underground mines, and they often operate under much looser permitting requirements.
And the data definitely highlights who is bearing the brunt of this blind spot. I mean, construction sand and gravel operations, along with bituminous coal operations, were hit the hardest in 2025.
Right, recording 4 fatalities each.
And bituminous coal is that softer black coal that is very often extracted via surface strip mining.
Exactly. Barker's making a very pointed statistical argument here. If your operation is sand, gravel, or surface coal, you are not immune. Your peers are the ones dying on the haul roads and at the crushers.
The harsh reality is that a miner is more likely to lose their life in the yard than deep underground.
Which is a tough pill to swallow for a lot of veterans in the industry.
Which brings us to arguably the most frustrating question of this entire analysis.
Let's hear it.
If we know exactly how these machines fail, and we know exactly where it's happening, out in the open on the surface, why aren't things actually improving?
That is the million-dollar question.
Right. We have to look at the massive gap between bureaucratic paperwork and boots-on-the-ground culture. Because after the brutal spike in fatalities in early 2025, MSHA issued that 4-point safety alert we talked about.
Right. The memos went out.
Yeah. They told the industry to, 1, identify and eliminate hazards, 2, establish effective safety programs, 3, conduct thorough workplace exams, and 4, provide hazard recognition training.
That's pretty comprehensive, right?
Well, I'm going to be a little cynical here.
Go right ahead.
Isn't this just the definition of bureaucratic boilerplate?
Yeah.
Hasn't MSHA been telling mine operators to identify hazards since the agency was literally founded?
You're not wrong.
How does issuing another memo with 4 generic bullet points actually change human behavior on a real job site?
Your cynicism is entirely justified. And honestly, Barker explicitly validates that pushback in his article.
He does.
Yeah. The guidance from MSHA is technically sound, but it is absolutely not new. Telling people to be safe is not a groundbreaking strategy.
Right. It's kind of insulting to their intelligence, honestly.
Exactly. The gap here is not a lack of knowledge. Nobody running a multi-million dollar mine in 2025 is totally unaware that they need to identify hazards. The gap is entirely in the execution.
It's the difference between the sites that just collect citations from inspectors and the sites that actually bring their people home alive at the end of the shift.
Precisely. Barker argues that the dividing line is leadership.
Leadership.
It is about whether leadership has successfully built a culture where hazards are actively reported, examined, and fixed in real time.
Rather than being minimized or pushed to, you know, a next quarter maintenance schedule because fixing it today would halt production.
Exactly. Production pressure is the enemy of execution here.
So let's break down what that execution actually looks like using MSHA's own points. Like, they demand thorough workplace exams.
Right.
But a workplace exam is just a supervisor walking around with a clipboard, unless that person is actually empowered to stop work.
That's the key right there, empowerment.
Like, if a worker sees a crack in the high wall or notices that the berm is washed out, do they have the actual authority to halt an entire fleet of massive haul trucks, knowing it will cost the company tens of thousands of dollars in delayed production?
And if the answer is no, then the exam is completely useless.
Just theater stood.
Yeah, it becomes an exercise in pencil lipping, just checking boxes to ensure the paperwork is legally compliant if an inspector shows up.
Right, the safety binder on the manager's desk essentially becomes a very thick, very expensive paperweight.
That provides nothing but an illusion of control.
The exact same logic applies to MSHA's demand for hazard recognition training.
Oh, absolutely.
You can put workers in a classroom and teach them fluid dynamics and trench safety all day long. But that training only works out in the yard if the workers know that reporting an issue won't get them labeled as a troublemaker by their foreman.
Yeah, culture eats policy for breakfast.
It really does. If the organizational culture punishes the person who points out the leaky roof by cutting their shifts or passing them over for a promotion, people will simply stop looking at the ceiling.
A true safety culture actually rewards the person who stops the production line to fix a hazard.
Right.
It means the safety programs are driven by individuals who are held accountable for physical outcomes, not just compliance metrics.
Checking boxes isn't enough.
No. The tragic spike in 2025 is just a really grim testament to what happens when that illusion of control shatters and the gap between the paperwork and the actual site culture is totally exposed.
To pull all of this together, 2025 was a tragic step backward that proved the incredible success of 2024 cannot be taken for granted.
No, it can't.
You cannot cross the finish line in December, pat yourself on the back, and assume the bureaucratic system will just seamlessly run itself the following year. Safety is a daily, relentless practice.
It is. And if you manage a site or if you oversee contractors, Barker's immediate practical advice is to stop relying on assumptions today.
Go pull your powered haulage procedures.
Right. Physically walk out and check your berm standards this afternoon.
Walk your surface operations with fresh eyes, deliberately ignoring the sunlight and the open air, to ensure your workplace exams are actually identifying hazards and not just pencil whipping a checklist.
Exactly.
Because the causes, right? The trucks, the pressurized machinery, the uncompacted ground, they aren't mysteries.
We know exactly what they are.
Right. The knowledge to prevent them is universally available. The only question is whether an organization has the discipline to prioritize that knowledge over production every single day.
Which is much harder in practice than it is on paper.
Definitely. And that brings us to a final thought for you to mull over. Think about your own industry, your own workplace, your own daily routines, even if they have absolutely nothing to do with heavy machinery or mining.
Yeah, it applies everywhere.
We talked at the very beginning about that comforting expectation of progress, right? That feeling when you've had a great year and you feel like you've got all your risks under control. But ask yourself, where is your surface operation?
That's a great question.
What is that glaring systemic hazard that you and your team walk past every single day right out in the open because you've all just collectively normalized the deviance and agreed it's safe enough?
Yeah.
And what would happen to your people if that acceptable risk finally caught up with you today? Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.